depth of that layer precisely proportionate to the severity of the impropriety in question. Even the most malevolent, it appears, must find justification for his or her evil. If we fail to hold ourselves to that standard of responsibility, then other people regard us as lacking in ethics and integrity, and it does not end there. Just as we hold people, including ourselves, accountable for the wrongs they have done or the good they have failed to do, we also believe, or at least act out the proposition, that someone who has made a good decision freely deserves whatever benefit might come of it. It is for that reason that we believe each person should justly receive the fruit of their honest and voluntary labor. There seems something natural and inevitable about such judgments, something at work within us that is universal and inescapable, psychologically and socially. What all this means is that everyone, child, adult, self, others, will rebel against being treated as a cog in a wheel, incapable of choice and devoid of freedom, and similarly, that it is practically impossible to establish a positive relationship with any other, or even our private selves, without that attribution of personal agency, free will, and responsibility. The Word as Savior. The twin ideas that we all are, as sovereign individuals, first, voluntarily participating in the act of creation itself, and second, determining the quality of that creation with the ethics of our choices, finds reflection in myriad manners within our relationships, private and public. These ideas are also encapsulated and represented in the narratives, the fundamental narratives that sit at the base of our culture. These stories, whatever their ultimate metaphysical significance, are at least in part a consequence of our watching ourselves act across eons of human history and distilling from that watching the essential patterns of our actions. We are cartographers, makers of maps, geographers, concerned with the layout of the land. But we are also, more precisely and accurately, charters of courses, sailors and explorers. We recall the places we started from, the positions we occupied when our stories began. We remember the pitfalls and successes of the past so that we can avoid the former and repeat the latter. To do so, we need to know where we have been, where we currently are, and in what direction we are headed. We reduce that account to its causal structure. We need to know what happened and why, and we need to know it as simply and practically as possible. It is for such reasons we are so captivated by people who can tell a story, who can share their experiences concisely and precisely, and who get to the point. That point, the moral of the story, is what they learned about who and where they were or are, and where they are going and why. Such information is irresistible to us all. It is how and why we derive wisdom from the risks taken by those before us and who live to tell the story. This is what life was like then. This is what we wanted and why. This is what we envisioned and how we strategized, planned, and then acted. Sometimes we succeeded and realized our aims. But too often, and this is what is crucial to a great story, here is how what we did not expect occurred. Here is how we were knocked off the path. Here are the tragedies we encountered and the mistakes we made. And here is how we put the world back together or failed to do so. We value such stories particularly if they have attained the pinnacle of generalizability, representing heroic battles with the unknown as such, or the dissolution of tyrannical order into revivifying chaos and the reestablishment of benevolent society. This can be seen everywhere that people tell and listen avidly to stories, and that is literally everywhere. The most fundamental stories of the West are to be found, for better or worse, in the biblical corpus. That collection of ancient and eminently influential books opens with God himself in his fatherly guise, portrayed as the ordered entity who confronts chaos and creates habitable order in consequence. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. Genesis 1:2. This formlessness, void, darkness, and water, a confusing conglomeration of attributes, is a consequence of the translation of a biblical Hebrew phrase, toyu wa boyu, made up of two words, toyu and boyu. Toyu is even more complicated than mere formlessness, etc. It also means that which is laid waste, vanity, which might be something likely to be laid to waste, psychologically speaking, and desert, which is uninhabitable and void. It is also associated with another Hebrew word, teom, which is the source of the phrase the deep. Teom, in turn, means the abyss, and is associated with an earlier Sumerian term, Tiamat, who is the great mother goddess, dragon, and denizen of salt water, who creates the world with her consort Apsu in the Mesopotamian creation myth, Enuma Elish. According to the Genesis account, there exists something, a potential, let us say, associated symbolically with the abyss, with the oceanic depths, but also with desert, dragons, maternality / matriarchy, emptiness, formlessness, and darkness. This is all the attempt of poetry and metaphor to give initial, ordered, conceptual form to the formless. The abyss is what terrifies, what is at the end of the earth, what we gaze upon when contemplating our mortality and fragility, and what devours hope. Water is depth and the source of life itself. The desert is a place of abandonment, isolation, and loneliness, as well as the interregnum between tyranny and the promised land. The dragon is the ancient image of the predator as such, the fire-breathing tree, cat, snake, bird, eternally lurking in the forest beyond the familiar confines of tribe and village. It is as well the Leviathan hidden in the salt water, the depths. The terrible monster Jehovah refers to overcoming in Job 41:25-34 and in many other places in the Old Testament accounts. God has an attribute, or an alternative person, or a faculty, or a tool that aids him or that he relies on when confronting possibility and the void. That is the word from the Christian perspective, but certainly the capacity for speech, regardless of religious framework, Jewish or Christian. There is a continual insistence in Genesis on the importance of speech. The act of creation on each day begins with the phrase, "And God said," with additional emphasis on the act of naming, "And God called." The 7 days of creation begin. "And God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And the evening and the morning were the first day." Genesis 1:3-5. Almost immediately after God first reveals himself, his creative actions, and the initial creation, thus, almost instantly after we are introduced to him, he creates human beings. Three features of that creation stand forth in addition to its immediacy: the insistence that mankind is to have dominion over the rest of creation, the shocking and incomprehensibly modern and egalitarian insistence that God created man and woman equally in his own image, stated twice, Genesis 1:27. And the equally unlikely and miraculous insistence that the creation of humanity was, like the rest of the creation, good. If God is, above all, as he is initially described, that implies that the men and women created in his image share with him something of import, or, more to the point, they share an analogous destiny, necessity, or responsibility. The word, the tool God uses to transform the depths of potential, is truthful speech. It appears necessarily allied, however, with the courage to confront unrealized possibility in all its awful potential so that reality itself may be brought forth. Perhaps both this truth and courage must finally be subsumed in turn under the broader principle of love. Love for being itself despite its fragility, tyranny, and betrayal. Love that has as its aim what is best for the best in everything. It is that combination of truth, courage, and love comprising the ideal, whose active incarnation in each individual does, in fact, take the potential of the future and make the best of it. And who would deny this? No one teaches a beloved son to cringe in terror and cowardice from what confronts him. No one teaches a beloved daughter that deceit will set the world right and that whatever works expediently is to be practiced, honored, and mimicked. And no one tells anyone he or she cares for that the proper response to being is hatred and the desire to produce pain, suffering, mayhem, and catastrophe. Thus, it can be assumed from analysis of our own behavior that we know the difference between the pathway of good and the pathway of evil, and that we believe above all, despite our conscious resistance and prideful argument, in the existence of both. But there is yet more. The insistence of God on the goodness of creation reflected the fact that truth, courage, and love were united in his creative action. Thus, there is an ethical claim deeply embedded in the Genesis account of creation. Everything that emerges from the realm of possibility in the act of creation, arguably either divine or human, is good insofar as the motive for its creation is good. I do not believe there is a more daring argument in all of philosophy or in theology than this. To believe this, to act it out, is the fundamental act of faith. There is an argument presented much later in the biblical narrative in the New Testament. Christ says the following words to his followers. It is a commentary on the potential for completing your life, for reclaiming what you have lost, or even discovering what you did not know was there. And I say unto you, ask, and it shall be given you. Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you. For every one that asketh, receiveth, and he that seeketh, findeth, and to him that knocketh, it shall be opened. If a son shall ask bread of any of you that is a father, will he give him a stone? Or if he ask a fish, will he for a fish give him a serpent? Or if he shall ask an egg, will he offer him a scorpion? If ye then, being evil, know how to give good gifts unto your children, how much more shall your heavenly Father give the Holy Spirit to them that ask him? Luke 11:9-13. This is not a casual statement. It is not naive. It is not a matter of asking for a present unearned. God is no granter of casual wishes. It is a matter, first, of truly asking. This means being willing to let go of anything and everything that is not in keeping with the desire. Otherwise, there is no asking. There is only an immature and too often resentful whim and wish. Oh, that I could have what I want without doing what is necessary. That will not suffice. So, to ask, seek, and knock is to do everything required to gather what has been left unfinished and to complete it now. And to ask, seek, and knock is, as well, to determine what must be asked for. And that has to be something that is worthy of God. Why else would it be granted? How else could it possibly be granted? Imagine for a moment you have been given all you need. There is possibility within you, waiting for the proper demand to release itself. There is all that is outside of you, waiting to inform and teach you. But all of it is necessary. The good, bad, and unbearable. You know that when something does not go well, you should analyze the problem, resolve it, apologize, repent, and transform. An unsolved problem seldom sits there in stasis. It grows new heads like a hydra. One lie, one act of avoidance breeds the necessity for more. One act of self-deception generates the requirement to buttress that self-deceptive belief with new delusions. One devastated relationship, unaddressed, damages your reputation, damages your faith in yourself equally, and decreases the probability of a new and better relationship. Thus, your refusal or even inability to come to terms with the errors of the past expands the source of such error, expands the unknown that surrounds you, transforms that unknown into something increasingly predatory. And, while that is happening, you get weaker. You are less than you could be because you did not change. You did not become who you could have become as a consequence of that change. And worse, you have now taught yourself, by your own example, that such turning away is acceptable, a and you are therefore more likely to commit the same error in the future, and what you failed to face is now larger. This is not the kind of causal process, the kind of positive feedback loop that you want to find yourselves trapped within. So you must confess, at least to yourself, and repent, at least within yourself, and you must change because you were wrong. And you must humbly ask and knock and seek. And that is the great barrier to the enlightenment of which we are all capable in principle. This is not to claim that the courage necessary to confront the full horrors of life is easy to muster, but the alternative is worse. It is our destiny to transform chaos into order. If the past has not been ordered, the chaos it still constitutes haunts us. There is information, vital information, resting in the memories that affect us negatively. It is as if part of the personality is still lying latent out in the world, making itself manifest only in emotional disruption. What is traumatic but remains inexplicable indicates that the map of the world that guides our navigation is insufficient in some vital manner. It is necessary to understand the negative well enough so that it can be circumvented as we move into the future if we do not wish to remain tormented by the past. And it is not the expression of emotion associated with unpleasant events that has curative power. It is the development of a sophisticated causal theory. Why was I at risk? What was it about the world that made it dangerous? What was I doing or not doing to contribute to my vulnerability? How can I change the value hierarchy I inhabit to take the negative into account so that I can see and understand it? How much of my old map do I have to let crumble and burn with all the pain dying tissue produces before I can change enough to take my full range of experience into account? Do I have the faith to step beyond what should and must die and let my new and wiser personality emerge? To some great degree, we are our assumptions. They structure the world for us. When basic axioms of faith are challenged, people are basically good, the foundation shakes and the walls crumble. We have every reason to avoid facing the bitter truth. But making what is and what was clear and fully comprehended can only protect us. If you are suffering from memories that will not stop tormenting you, there is possibility that could be your very salvation, waiting there to be discovered. If old memories still upset you, write them down carefully and completely. Rule 10. Plan and work diligently to maintain the romance in your relationship. The unbearable date. I am not a couples therapist, but sometimes when I see a client, it becomes necessary to include his or her intimate partner in one or more sessions. I do that only when directly asked. I also make it clear that the couple should seek out a marital counseling specialist if that is their central goal. However, if one of the primary problems my client is addressing is dissatisfaction in the marriage, it is often counterproductive to speak with only one member of the couple. Finally, it is often the case, and no wonder really, that the partner in question does not trust his or her better half's therapist, me, and a meeting with all three of us can go a long way toward rectifying that. Prior to meeting with a couple, I will have discussed some basic rules for relationship improvement with my client. Let us say he or she has decided to make some time for romance, 4 hours a week or something like that. I'm speaking here of adults with their full share of responsibilities. Maybe that much can be managed. Maybe even more is possible. But there is not that much time in 7 days, and the situation must be set up correctly and carefully. And when all this is first practiced, all this conscious negotiation and enactment, it is going to be done badly and stupidly with all the attendant pain, resentment, and vengefulness. And then such negative emotion can be nursed and the relationship damaged, sometimes permanently. Perhaps my client and his or her partner have become estranged from one another over several years when we first start to discuss their situation. They are not happy, and they hate me, maybe even more than they hate each other. They sit there, distant, arms crossed and eyes rolling. Hopefully not the latter. That is a bad sign. Neither will give an inch. I asked them when they last did something romantic together, when they last went out together for a date. They laugh ruefully if things have not gone too far, or scoff outright. I suggest, nonetheless, that they try going out with each other, or more, that they start making dates a regular practice. The former suggestion is bad enough, the second intolerable. They indicate, "We are not going on any damn dates. We dated before we got married, when it was appropriate. Besides, all we will do is fight." And here is my take on that angry, bitter, and shallow response. This is the theory you are putting forth. You are never going to accompany each other on another date in your entire married life. So much for romance and intimacy. Instead, you're just going to give that up. Why not, instead, risk the time? Take each other somewhere nice. Dare to put your arm around your partner or your hand on a knee, and not your own either. I know you are angry with each other, and probably for good reason. I've met both of you. I understand why you feel that way. But just try it. You do not have to like it. You do not have to expect to be good at it or give up your anger or have a good time. You just have to tolerate it. They both leave incensed at me for suggesting such an irritating idea. But they agree grudgingly and at their next session inform me. It happened just as we told you. We had an absolutely wretched time. We fought before we went out, while we were out, and again when we returned home. We are certainly not going to risk a date again. They often evince a certain pride at reaching such a conclusion, as both had generally decided ahead of time that the whole idea was pointless. So, I ask, that is the plan, is it? You're going to be married for 60 years. You put a small amount of begrudging effort into having one date. You were already not getting along, so there was a negligible probability you were going to take any pleasure in it. Besides that, irritated at me as you were for my childish suggestion, you were both motivated to make it go horribly, just as it did. So, you're done with it, and now you have decided that this is how you're going to conduct yourselves across the decades you have promised each other, with spite and bitterness, instead of mutual regard? Let us try thinking about it this way instead. Neither of you have any skill at dating. One attempt is therefore going to be insufficient. Maybe you need 15 dates, or 40, because you have lost the knack, need the practice, and must develop the habit and goodwill. Perhaps neither of you are very romantic to begin with, or if you were once, those days have long gone. This is a skill you must learn, not an unearned gift from Cupid. Assume you are married, or the equivalent. Assume as well that you have, or could have, a romantic interlude twice a week. It may be less, it may be more, but we will do the arithmetic for twice weekly. That is 100 times a year. Let us imagine that you're going to be married 30 more years. 30 times 100 is 3,000 times. Is there not some possibility that you could devote a fraction of all the time to perfecting your techniques of seduction, communication, and lovemaking? What does it matter, therefore, if you have 15 miserable dates before managing one that verges on acceptable? That's 15 times out of a possible 3,000. That is 0.5% of the romantic time you could possibly spend together. Maybe you could dare even more to determine if things could be set right between you. Why would you possibly assume that something as complex as maintaining a marriage could be managed without commitment, practice, and effort? So maybe the first date is wretched and horrible. You never want to repeat it, but you do because you would rather save your marriage than quit outright. And maybe the next one is 5% better. And maybe after some repeated attempts, you remember for at least a brief moment why you once liked the person you married. Perhaps you manage something a little more exciting than putting your arm around him or her, and perhaps receive a bit of response from someone who actually cares for you somewhere in their now cold and shriveled heart. And if you are in it for the long run, as indicated by the original marital vows, perhaps you will put in the time to get it right. And Maybe the couple has enough sense to do the arithmetic and contemplate all that wasted time, as well as the bitterness, resentment, and deadness of life without romance, and they agree to go on another date, or two, or three, or 10. And by the 10th session, they come to see me smiling and tell me they had a pretty good time. And then we have an even more serious discussion about just what it takes to maintain love and respect and invoke desire and response. How do you find the mystery in the other person over the long run? Can you muster up the will and the romantic imagination and the playfulness to manage that each time you are together intimately for the next 3,000 occasions? That is going to require some thoughtful effort. For each person is, in truth, an unfathomable enigma. With care, you might keep rediscovering in the person you have chosen enough residual mystery to maintain the spirit that first brought you together. With care, you can avoid stowing each other away in a conveniently sized box, punishment at hand should either of you dare to emerge, and contempt for the consequent predictability you now both face, lurking not so far beneath the surface. If you are fortunate, you might rekindle that glimpse you had when you first were attracted to each other of what your life could be like if you were better people than you are. That is what happens when two people fall under the spell of love. For a while, both become better than they were and see that. But then that magic fades away. Both receive that experience as a gift. Both have their eyes opened and can see what is visible to no one else. Such love is a glimpse of what could be if the relationship remained true. It is delivered as a gift initially from fate, but requires tremendous effort to realize and maintain. And once that is understood, the goal is clear. Bedrock. The sexual aspect of a relationship can often tell us a great deal about the whole, but not always. I have known couples who fought like proverbial cats and dogs and who had a wildly successful sex life, at least in the short term, and other couples who were well suited to each other temperamentally, but one or the other could not find the spark. People and their relationships are too complex to reduce to a single aspect. But it is still reasonable to note that a good marriage is accompanied by mutual desire, mutually requited. Unfortunately, desire is not something that can be managed by itself. Let us fix our sex life is a resolution too narrow in ambition to fulfill its aim. There must be a broader, relationship-wide strategy in place to maintain romance with your partner across time. Regardless of what that strategy might be, its success is going to depend on your ability to negotiate. To negotiate, you and the person you are negotiating with must first know what you each need and want, and second, be willing to discuss both forthrightly. There are many serious obstacles both to knowing what you need and want, and to discussing it. If you allow yourself to know what you want, then you will also know precisely when you are failing to get it. You will benefit, of course, because you will also know when you have succeeded. But you might also fail, and you could well be frightened enough by the possibility of not getting what you need and want that you keep your desires vague and unspecified. And the chance that you will get what you want if you fail to aim for it is vanishingly small. Aim is likely a problem for you. If you have a partner, the problem may be compounded. The person you have chosen is unlikely to be any smarter about you than you are, except in minor instances. And is in fact likely to be even more in the dark with regard to your innermost desires. Your failure to specify your desires means your unfortunate lover will have to guess what would please and displease you and is likely to be punished in some manner for getting it wrong. Furthermore, given all the things you could want and do not want, it is virtually certain that your lover will get it wrong. In consequence, you will be motivated to blame them, at least implicitly or non-verbally or unconsciously, for not caring enough to notice what you are unwilling even to notice yourself. If you really loved me, you will think or feel without thinking, I would not have to tell you what would make me happy. This is not a practical approach to a happy marriage. That is all bad enough, But there's a second and equally severe problem lurking in the byways. If you have solved the problem of knowing what you want, admitted it to yourself in a verbalizable form, and let someone else know your wishes, you have then granted them a dangerous source of power. The person whom you have made your confidant is now in a position to fulfill your desires, but could equally deprive you of what you want, embarrass you for wanting it, or hurt you in some manner, because you have now made yourself vulnerable. Naive people are possessed of the delusion that everyone is good, and that no one, particularly someone loved, would be motivated to cause pain and misery, either for revenge, as a consequence of blindness, or merely for the pleasure of doing so. But people who have matured enough to transcend their naivety have learned that they can be hurt and betrayed both by themselves and at the hands of others. So, why increase the odds of being hurt by letting someone in? It is to defend against such betrayal that naivete is often replaced by cynicism, and it must be said in all truth that the latter is an improvement over the former. But such substitution is not the final word in wisdom, and thank God for that. Trust, in turn, trumps cynicism, and true trust is not naive. Trust between people who are not naive is a form of courage, because betrayal is always a possibility, and because this is consciously understood. This applies with particular force within the confines of an intimate relationship. To trust is to invite the best in your partner to manifest itself, with yourself and your freely given trust as the enticement. This is a risky business, but the alternative is the impossibility of true intimacy and the sacrifice of what could have been two minds in dialogue working in tandem to address the difficult problems of life for a single mind striving in solitude. Romance requires trust, and the deeper the trust, the deeper the possibility for romance. But trust has its requirements as well, apart from the courage required of the individuals wise enough to distrust, but brave enough to risk putting their faith in a partner. The first of those requirements is truth. You cannot maintain trust in yourself if you lie. You cannot maintain trust in yourself likewise if you act in a manner that would require a lie if it was discovered. Similarly, you cannot maintain trust in your partner if he or she lies or betrays you in action or in silence. So, the vow that makes a marriage capable of preserving its romantic component is first and foremost the decision not to lie to your partner. There are also immense practical advantages to this, if practiced properly. There will come a time in your life when you have done something you should not have done or failed to do something that you should have done. You may need advice. You may need support. You may need exactly what your partner could provide, if only you dared to allow them to help. And at some time, they are going to find themselves in exactly the same position. Life is too difficult to negotiate alone. If you tell your partner the truth, and you strive to act so that you can tell the truth about how you act, then you have someone to rely on when the seas become high and your ship threatens to founder. This can literally be a matter of life or death. In a relationship where romance remains intact, truth must be king. Christ in the candle. I have a friend of Scandinavian descent, although he is Canadian. He married a Canadian woman, also of Scandinavian descent. They decided to get married in Sweden as a tribute to their joint ancestry. They were both at least nominally Christian, so they were married in a ceremony reflecting that. During their exchange of vows, the bride and groom held a lit candle aloft between them. I spent a long time thinking about the significance of that ritual. There is an ancient conceit in the book of Genesis 2:21-22 that Eve was taken out of Adam, created from his rib. Woman from man. This presents something of a mystery, reversing, as it does, the normative biological sequence where males emerge from females at birth. It also gave rise to a line of mythological speculation attempting to account for the strangeness of this creative act, predicated on the supposition that Adam, the original man produced by God, was hermaphroditic, half masculine and half feminine, and only later separated into the two sexes. This implies not only the partition of a divinely produced unity, but the incompleteness of man and woman until each is brought together with the other. The fact that the candle is held jointly indicates the binding of the two celebrants. The fact that the candle is held aloft, lit, implies that something higher, something superordinate, is representing or performing the union. That is light, light in the heavens, light in the darkness, illumination, enlightenment. Something similar is symbolized by the use of candles at Christmas. Evergreens, the standard choice for Christmas trees, represent life unending as they do not die annually in the same manner as their deciduous counterparts. Such trees, therefore, symbolize the tree of life, which serves as the very foundation of the cosmos. We illuminate the tree of life with candles at or near December 21st, the darkest time of the year, at least in the Northern Hemisphere. That is also why Christmas is located where it is on the calendar. The reappearance of the light is associated with the birth of the universal Savior, signifying the eternal reemergence of light in the Stygian blackness. Christ has long been regarded as the second perfected Adam, and, just as there was speculation about the hermaphroditic nature of the first Adam prior to God's creation of the independent sexes, there is a line of speculation about Christ's spiritual perfection being a consequence of the ideal balance of masculine and feminine elements. It is very difficult for individuals joining themselves together to become desperate enough to cease their hiding and avoidance, live in truth, and repair themselves in the light cast by their joint existence. It is for this reason that both swear the dread vow of permanence, what God has joined together, let not man put asunder, Matthew 19:6. I am bound to you, claims one party to the agreement, and I to you, says the other, and both think, if they have any sense, that they should each transform themselves and one another to forestall any unnecessary suffering. So, what is the superordinate principle to which both marital partners must bow? It is not illumination as mere verbal abstraction. It is not that they are only supposed to think and speak the truth. It is that they are supposed to act it out. And that is the ancient idea that the word should be made flesh. The individuals who make up a married couple might well engage in a lifelong struggle concerning a single, inappropriately conceptualized question. Who is subordinate to whom in a marriage? After all, each might reason, as people commonly do, that such an arrangement is a zero-sum game with one winner and one loser. But a relationship does not have to be and should not be a question of one or the other as a winner, or even each alternating in that status in an approximation of fairness. Instead, the couple can decide that each and both are subordinate to a principle, a higher order principle, which constitutes their union in the spirit of illumination and truth. That ghostly figure, the ideal union of what is best in both personalities, should be constantly regarded as the ruler of the marriage, and, indeed, as something as close to divine as might be practically approached by fallible individuals. That is what the ceremony of the candle represents. Neither participant rules the other. Instead, both bow to the principle of illumination. In that circumstance, it is not that one must abide by what the other wants, or vice versa. Instead, it is that both should be oriented toward the most positive future possible and agree that speaking the truth is the best pathway forward. That orientation and truthfulness will engender a transformative dialogue, verbal and nonverbal, if the partners in the arrangement commit to abiding by the consequence of that dialogue. Voluntary subordination to this higher order principle of illumination both unifies and revitalizes. Imagine that you have just participated in such a ceremony. What does your participation signify? Do you believe in the ideas that you have just acted out? Do you believe that man and woman were once together as a single being, were then separated, and must be restored as a unity? You can believe it dramatically, poetically, and metaphorically instead of merely rationally and mechanically, and that can lead you to deep truths. Do you want to find your soulmate? It is a romantic trope, obviously, but there are deep reasons for the existence of romantic fictions. Maybe you take someone on a date to a romantic movie. You both watch the movie hero and heroine find their soulmates. If you are fortunate, while you are watching, you are thinking, well, maybe this person I'm sitting with is the one for me, too. In the best of all situations, that is also what your date is hoping for. Maybe that is too much to hope for in real life, but the romantic part of you is longing for it, regardless. There is an inevitable yearning in our natures for the completion that someone else might provide. There is a sense that you are missing something otherwise, and that only the proper romantic union will provide it. It is true, too. You are, indeed, missing something. If you were not, sex would have never evolved. The entire biological course of our destiny, since reproduction progressed past the mere division of cells, appears driven by the fact that it was better for two dissimilar creatures to come together to produce a comparatively novel version of themselves than to merely clone their current embodiment. You have your idiosyncrasies, your blind spots, your biases. Some of these are implicit. They are often paired inextricably with your unique talents. You seldom gain an advantage without a corresponding disadvantage, and you are a particular person with particular attributes. If you are on your own, you are inevitably lopsided, one-sided. That is often not for the best. There is unrealized utility in the marital institution about which we have become cynical, a consequence of our immaturity and naivety. A marriage is a vow, and there is a reason for it. You announce jointly, publicly, I am not going to leave you in sickness or health, in poverty or wealth, and you are not going to leave me. It is actually a threat. We are not getting rid of each other no matter what. You are shackled together like two angry cats at the bottom of a barrel with the lid on. In principle, there is no escape. If you have any sense, beside the optimism of new love, you also think, oh God, that is a horrifying possibility. The part of you that claims to desire freedom, but really wants to avoid any permanent and therefore terrifying responsibility, desires a trapdoor through which escape might be made if and when it is necessary. That seems convenient, and it is true that there are unbearable marriages, but it is an option with extreme perils. Do you really want to keep asking yourself for the rest of your life, because you would always have the option to leave, if you made the right choice? In all likelihood, you did not. There are 7 billion people in the world. At least 100 million, let us say, might have made good partners for you. You certainly did not have time to try them out, and the probability that you found the theoretically optimal person approaches zero. But you do not find so much as make. And if you do not know that, you are in real trouble. Furthermore, if you have an escape route, there will not be enough heat generated in the chamber you find yourself jointly trapped in to catalyze the change necessary in both of you, the maturation, the development of wisdom. Because maturation and the development of wisdom require a certain degree of suffering, and suffering is escapable as long as there is an out. You are not going to get along with your partner because you are different people. Not easily, anyway, unless you agree to be tyrannized and silent, and even then you will take your revenge. No one just simply gets along, precisely because of that. And not only are you different from your partner, but you are rife with inadequacies, and so is he or she. And that is not bad enough. There is also the fact that even people of good will and character locked together in matrimony will face the mundane, quotidian, dull, tragic and terrible together, because life can be, and certainly will be at some point, difficult to the point of impossibility. It is going to be tough. Even if you strive to pull yourselves together and succeed at that admirably, there are going to be brutal times, and they are not necessarily going to be brief. Maybe life will be better if you stay together. That is the hope and the likelihood, as far as I can tell. But the brutal times will still be there. What is going to make you voluntarily deal with your differences and establish a genuine agreement, a true consensus? You are going to have to negotiate in good faith continually to come to some sort of peaceful and productive accommodation. And if you do not, you are going to have your hands around each other's throats for 60 years. In clinical practice, I have seen whole families in that situation. Imagine five people in a circle. Imagine, further, that each has their hands around the neck of the person in front of them. All are squeezing with just enough force to kill in a few decades. This is a decision formulated over years of unspoken argument and refusal to negotiate. I am going to kill you. It is just going to take me a lifetime. It is very possible that you have someone you might like to slowly throttle in your family or who is currently doing it to you. Perhaps not. Hopefully not. Perhaps you would not admit it, even if you knew it was true. But it is common enough. If you do not negotiate peace with your partner, that is the situation you will find yourself in. There are three fundamental states of social being. Tyranny. You do what I want. Slavery. I do what you want. Or negotiation. Tyranny is obviously not so good for the person enslaved. But it is also not good for the tyrant, because he or she becomes a tyrant, and there is nothing ennobling about that. There is nothing but cynicism, cruelty, and the hell of unregulated anger and impulsivity. Slavery is not good either, likewise for the slave and the tyrant. Slaves are miserable, wretched, angry, and resentful. They will take any and all chances whatsoever available to them to take revenge on their tyrants, who will in consequence find themselves cursed and damaged by their slaves. It is not easy to get the best out of someone by arbitrarily brandishing a stick at them, particularly when they try to do something good, and that diminution of spirit is the cruelest trick of the tyrant. But you can be certain you want to be tyrants, that your slaves will take their revenge where they can, even if that means merely being much less than they could be. My wife told me a terrible story once about a couple she observed while volunteering in a palliative care ward. The husband was dying, and his wife was trimming his nails, a little too close. With each clip, there was blood as she trimmed close enough to damage the quick. You see something like that, and wisdom speaks its terrible truth. I know exactly what is going on there. That is the end stage of an unbelievably deceitful and brutal relationship. It is subtle. It does not announce itself loudly as murderous. No one knows, except the couple, even though they are perhaps striving with all their might under the circumstances not to know, and the careful observer, who sees a dying man and a wife who has determined, for whatever reasons, to make his death a little worse. That is not a desirable outcome. You do not want to end up in that situation or anything like it. You want to negotiate. The question is, what is going to make you desperate enough to negotiate? And that is one of the mysteries that must be addressed if you wish to keep the romance alive in your relationship. Negotiation, tyranny, or slavery? Negotiation is exceptionally difficult. We already discussed the problems associated with determining what you want and then mustering up the courage to tell someone exactly that. And there are the tricks that people use, too, to avoid negotiation. Perhaps you ask your partner what he or she wants, perhaps during a difficult situation. "I don't know," is a common answer. You get that from children, too, and even more often from adolescents. It is not acceptable, however, in a discussion that cannot in good faith be avoided. Sometimes, "I don't know," truly means what it is supposed to mean. The person who utters the phrase is at a genuine loss. But often it means instead, "I don't want to talk about it, so go away and leave me alone." Irritation or outright anger, sufficient to deter the questioner, often accompanies this response. That brings the discussion to a halt. And it can stay halted forever. Maybe that has happened once or twice or a dozen times too often. So you, the questioner in this instance, have had enough of your partner's refusal, and you have decided that you are done being cowardly or a victim of your own misplaced compassion, and you are not about to take "I don't know" for an answer. In consequence, you persist in pursuing your target. "Well, guess," you might say. "Throw something on the table, for God's sake. I do not care what it is. Even if it is wrong, it is at least a start." "I don't know" means not only "go away and leave me alone." It also frequently means Why don't you go away, do all the work necessary to figure out what is wrong, and come back and tell me if you're so smart? Or, it is intolerably rude of you to refuse to allow me to remain in my willful or dangerous ignorance, given that it obviously bothers me so much to think about my problems. It is not rude, though. Or, even if it is, you still need to know what your partner wants, and so does he or she. And how in the world are either or both of you going to figure it out if you cannot even get the conversation off the ground? It is not rude. It is a cruel act of love. Persistence under such conditions is a necessity, a terrible necessity, akin to surgery. It is difficult and painful because it takes courage and even some foolhardiness to continue a discussion when you have been told in no uncertain terms by your partner to go the hell away. Or worse. It is a good thing, however, an admirable act, because a person bothered by something they do not wish to talk about is very likely to be split internally over the issue at hand. The part that wants to avoid is the part that gets angry. There is a part that wants to talk, too, and to settle the issue, but doing so is going to be cognitively demanding, ethically challenging, and emotionally stressful. In addition, it is going to require trust. And people test trust, not least by manifesting anger when approached about something touchy, just to determine if the person daring the approach cares sufficiently to overcome a serious barrier or two or three or ten to get to the horrible bottom of things. An avoidance followed by anger is not the only trick in the book. The next serious hurdle is tears. Tears are easily mistaken for the distress due to sadness, and they are very effective at bringing tender-hearted people to a dead halt as a consequence of their misplaced compassion. Why misplaced? Because if you leave the person alone because of their tears, they quit suffering right then, but continue with their unresolved problem until they solve it, which might be never. Tears, however, are just as often anger, perhaps more often, as they are sadness or distress. If the person you are chasing down and cornering is red-faced, for example, in addition to their tears, then he or she is probably angry, not hurt. That is not inevitably the case, but it is a reasonably common sign. Tears are an effective defense mechanism, as it takes a heart of stone to withstand them, but they tend to be the last-ditch attempt at avoidance. If you can get past tears, you can have a real conversation. But it takes a very determined interlocutor to avoid the insult and hurt generated by anger, defense one, and the pity and compassion evoked by tears, defense two. It requires someone who has integrated their shadow, their stubbornness, harshness, and capacity for necessary emotionless implacability, and can use it for long-term benefit. Do not foolishly confuse nice with good. Remember the options previously discussed. Negotiation, tyranny, or slavery. Of these, negotiation is the least awful, even though it is no joke to negotiate. It is also the most difficult of the three, at least in the short term, because you have to fight it out now, and God only knows how deep you are going to have to go and how much diseased tissue you will have to remove. For all you know, you are fighting with the spirit of your wife's grandmother, who was treated terribly by her alcoholic husband, and the consequences of that unresolved abuse and distrust between the sexes have echoed down the generations. Children are amazing mimics. They learn much of what they know implicitly long before they can use language, and they imitate the bad along with the good. It is for this reason that it has been said that the sins of the fathers will be visited on the children to the third and fourth generation. Numbers 14:18. Hope, of course, can drive us through the pain of negotiation, but hope is not enough. You need desperation as well, and that is part of the utility of till death do us part. You are stuck with each other if you are serious, and if you are not serious, you are still a child. That is the point of the vow, the possibility of mutual salvation, or the closest you can manage here on earth. In a truly mature marriage, if your health holds out, you are there for the aforementioned 60 years, more time than Moses spent in the desert searching for the promised land, and there is plenty of trouble that must be worked through before peace might be established. So, You grow up when you marry, and you aim for peace as if your soul depends on it, and perhaps that is more serious than your life depending on it, and you make it work or you suffer miserably. You will be tempted by avoidance, anger, and tears, or enticed to employ the trapdoor of divorce, so that you will not have to face what must be faced. But your failure will haunt you while you are enraged, weeping, or in the process of separating, as it will in the next relationship you stumble into with all your unsolved problems intact and your negotiating skills not improved a whit. You can keep the possibility of escape in the back of your mind. You can avoid the commitment of permanence. But then you cannot achieve the transformation, which might well demand everything you can possibly muster. Remember, the difficulty implicit in the negotiation carries with it a tremendous promise, which is part of a radically successful life. You could have a marriage that works. You could make it work. That is an achievement, a tangible, challenging, exceptional, and unlikely achievement. There are not many genuine achievements of that magnitude in life. Maybe, if you strive for it, you have established a solid marriage. That is one achievement. Because of that, you have founded a solid and reliable, honest and playful home into which you could dare bring children. Then you can have kids, and with a solid marriage, that can work out for you. That is another achievement. Then you have brought upon yourself more of the responsibility that will demand the best from you. Then you will have new relationships of the highest quality if you are fortunate and careful. Then you will have grandchildren so that you are surrounded by new life when yours begins to slip away. In our culture, we live as if we are going to die at 30, but we do not. We live a very long time, but it is also all over in a flash. You should be careful, therefore, to live your life fully. And marriage and children and grandchildren and all the trouble and heartbreak that accompanies all of that is much of what life has to offer. Miss it at your great peril. You meet people, usually young, unwise, but laden with the unearned cynicism that substitutes for wisdom in youth, and they say, categorically, even pridefully, "I do not want children." Plenty of 19-year-olds say that, and that is acceptable in some sense because they are 19 and they have time, and what do they know at 19 anyway? And some 27-year-olds say that, but not so many, particularly if they are female and the least bit honest with themselves. And some 45-year-olds say the same thing in the past tense, and some of them perhaps are telling the truth, but most are celebrating closing the barn door after the cattle have bolted. No one will speak the truth about this. To note outright that we lie to young women in particular about what they are most likely to want in life is taboo in our culture, with its incomprehensibly strange insistence that the primary satisfaction in the typical person's life is to be found in career, a rarity in itself, as most people have jobs, not careers. But it is an uncommon woman, in my clinical and general professional experience. Regardless of brilliance or talent, training, discipline, parental desire, youthful delusion, or cultural brainwashing, who would not perform whatever sacrifice necessary to bring a child into the world by the time she is 29 or 35 or worse, 40. Here is a pathway to misery I would strongly recommend avoiding, aimed primarily at the women who read this book, although wise boyfriends and husbands should take equal note. Decide that you want children when you are 29 or 30, and then be unable to have them. I would not recommend that. You will not recover. We are too fragile to play around with what life might offer us. Everyone thinks when they are young and do not know any better, well, pregnancy can be taken for granted. That is only true if you absolutely do not want and should not have a child, and you have sex in the backseat of a car when you are 15. Then, for sure, you will find yourself in trouble. But a successful pregnancy is not a foregone conclusion, not by any stretch of the imagination. You can push trying for children to the older end of the fertility range, and many people are encouraged or encourage themselves to do exactly that, but up to 30% of couples experience trouble becoming pregnant. You encounter something similar, that is, the incaution about what life will and will not offer. When people whose marriages have stagnated begin to develop the delusion that a romantic affair will address their unmet needs. When I had clients considering such a move, or perhaps involved in an affair currently, I tried to bring them back down to earth. Let us think it through, all the way, not just for this week or this month. You are 50. You have this 24-year-old, and she is willing to break up your marriage. What is she thinking? Who must she be? What does she know? Well, I'm really attracted to her. Yes, but she has a personality disorder. Seriously, because what the hell is she doing with you? And why is she willing to break up this marriage? Well, she does not care if I stay married. Oh, I see. So she does not want to have an actual relationship with someone with any degree of long-term permanency. Somehow, that is going to work out well for you, is it? Just think about that. It's going to be a little rough on your wife. A lot of lies are going to go along with that. You have children. How are they going to respond when all this comes out, as it most certainly will? And what do you think about the 10 years in court that are now beckoning, that are going to cost you $333,000 and put you in a custody battle that will occupy all your time and attention? I have seen people who were in custody battles who would seriously have preferred cancer. It is no joke to have your arm caught in the dangerous machinery of the courts. You spend much of the time truly wishing you were dead. So that is your affair, for God's sake. It is even more delusional than that, because of course if you are married to someone, you often see them at their worst, because you have to share the genuine difficulties of life with them. You save the easy parts for your adulterous partner. No responsibility, just expensive restaurants, exciting nights of rule-breaking, careful preparation for romance, and the general absence of reality that accompanies the privilege of making one person pay for the real troubles of existence while the other benefits unrealistically from their absence. You do not have a life with someone when you have an affair with them. You have an endless array of desserts, at least in the beginning, and all you have to do is scoop the whipped cream off the top of each of them and devour it. That is it. You see each other under the best possible conditions, with nothing but sex on your minds and nothing else interfering with your lives. As soon as it transforms from that into a relationship that has any permanency, a huge part of the affair immediately turns right back into whatever it was that was bothering you about your marriage. An affair is not helpful, and people end up horribly hurt, particularly children, and it is to them you owe primary allegiance. I am not trying to be unreasonably categorical about marriage and family. You cannot expect every social institution to work out for everyone. Sometimes you have married someone who is a psychopathic brute, a congenital and incorrigible liar, a criminal, an alcoholic, a sadist, and maybe all five at once. Then you must escape. But that is not a trapdoor. That is a catastrophe, like a hurricane, and you should move out of its path. You might be tempted to conclude, well, how about we live together instead of getting married? We will try each other out. It is the sensible thing to do. But what exactly does it mean when you invite someone to live with you instead of committing yourself to each other? And let us be appropriately harsh and realistic about our appraisal instead of pretending we are just taking a used car for a jaunt. Here is what it means. You will do. For now, and I presume you feel the same way about me. Otherwise, we would just get married. But in the name of a common sense that neither of us possesses, we are going to reserve the right to swap each other out for a better option at any point. And if you do not think that is what living together means, as a fully articulated ethical statement, see if you can formulate something more plausible. You might think, look, Doc, that is pretty cynical. So why not consider the stats, instead of the opinion of arguably, but not truly, old-fashioned me? The breakup rate among people who are not married but are living together, so married in everything but the formal sense, is substantially higher than the divorce rate among married couples. And even if you do get married, and make an honest person, so to speak, of the individual with whom you cohabited, you are still much more likely to get divorced than you would be had you never lived together initially. So, the idea of trying each other out? Sounds enticing. but does not work. It is, of course, possible that people who are more likely to get divorced are also more likely to live together before or without marriage, rather or in addition to the possibility that living together just does not work. It is no simple matter to disentangle the two causal factors. But it does not matter practically. Cohabitation without the promise of permanent commitment, socially announced, ceremonially established, seriously considered, does not produce more robust marriages. And there is nothing good about that, particularly for children, who do much worse in single-parent, generally male-absent, families. So I just do not see it as a justifiable social alternative. And I say that as someone who lived with my wife before I married her. I am not innocent in this regard. But that does not mean I was right. And there is something else, and it is far from trivial. You just do not have that many chances in life to have an intimate relationship work out properly. Maybe it takes you 2 or 3 years to meet the potential Mr. or Ms. Right, and another 2 to 3 to determine if they are in fact who you think they are. That is